this form protein, an amyloid protein? Anything else we know about it? Okay, so there's no nucleic information, so that's one of the reasons why we think it's really not, quote, alive. But it does direct, in an odd manner, it directs the production of other amyloid proteins. And that's why it's associated with the spread of, sort of, infectious spread. It's associated with brain tissue and central nervous system tissue. And so we have aided the prior practice of grinding up brain tissue and nervous central nervous system, spinal cord, that kind of stuff, and putting it into the animal feed. So we used to grind up animals and feed them to animals. And I'm sure we still do that, but we don't do that with central nervous system brain tissue. Odd as that sounds, or gross as that sounds, that's the end of the beast. It's also difficult to, quote, destroy. It doesn't, if you autoclave prions and so on, it doesn't seem to affect them any. So it's difficult to get rid of them in that sense. And the study of them is going to be important because it does cause brain tissue kinds of problems, diseases. Mad cow, spongiform, bovine spongiform encephalitis, the mad cow disease. One kuru being another one. Kuru is associated largely with humans eating brain tissue of cannibals, and that kind of thing. It's not a common problem. But now mad cow disease does have a concern. It gets into the beef system. So we have had people die of that, and it's a concern. But in a broader biological understanding of what amyloid protein does and doesn't do, how it builds up in the brain, how it's normally metabolized, and how it can be not normally metabolized. Does amyloid protein form plaques, and the plaques disrupt mental function, and it's associated with Alzheimer's disease. And so there's a lot of medications that are being developed, obviously because there's a lot of baby boomers and growers and no senses and somebody wants to sell us drugs and all that kind of stuff. So basically, the market is there. It's not sort of an orphan disease in which six people get it, so no drug company wants to blow up a drug for it. But here's clearly a, quote, marketable product. And yet we don't understand the mechanism clearly, but it does avoid involve the metabolism of amyloid proteins and the buildup of plaques in the brain and that sort of stuff. So there's an overlap. Note that I did not say that Alzheimer's disease is caused by a prion. We make that connection. We're making a sort of a chemical connection. There's a biochemical similarity of amyloid proteins and that sort of stuff. So just be aware of prions, but recognize they're not a microbial form. They are an unusual protein that can dictate the structure of other amyloid proteins, resulting in a buildup of these unusual amyloid proteins that are not broken down by the standard enzymes, and therefore we have problems. So we know a virus is alive in the sense that it has nucleic acid in the replicase. Its size, we said, was not the critical distinction between bacterial forms and viral forms because there is an overlap. Genomic nucleic acid, unlike other life forms, which has only double-stranded DNA, viruses may have any of four varieties, double, single-stranded, RNA or DNA, as their genomic material. That's where the heredity is kept. So that's an important observation. That difference, the type of nucleic acid that it has, can be an important target of opportunity for antiviral drugs. Different genetic information has to be copied with different sets of enzymes. Those transcriptases then are involved in targets of antiviral drugs. So we can classify the virus not only on their DNA or RNA genomic information, and not only on single or double-stranded DNA or RNA information, that we can do, but also in terms of whether it has an envelope or not. If it doesn't have an envelope, that outside structure, which is often crystalline in nature. It's called a nucleocapsid. And so we have a nucleocapsid, as you can see here, for this particular insect virus. That's sort of an interesting box shape. Other nucleocapsids also have their own crystalline-like structure. These, for the most part, are self-assembly proteins. So in the process of replication, once they are completed, they will form their own box. It's complicated as the box right here and the number of sides, but nonetheless, it can start to self-assembly. And that's for RNA or DNA viruses that are non-enveloped, the so-called naked nucleocapsid. The enveloped viruses have a lipid layer. And you can clearly see this on this herpes group virus. It's a lipid layer. So here's our nucleocapsid structure inside. But on the outside, you have a lipid layer. This is a lipid bilayer. Of note, viruses do not biosynthesize lipids. So here we have a structure that it cannot make that it has. So it steals the structure. It steals the structure from the host cell. It does so on the exiting from the host cell. So when we look at these different structures, enveloped and non-enveloped, it reveals the mechanism of release. If it is a non-enveloped naked nucleocapsid, it's released by a single process known as bursting. It basically, the host cell is just blown apart, and it frees the virus. In the case of the enveloped viruses, RNA or DNA, double or single stranded, but the enveloped viruses are all released by a process known as budding. Now, much like we have the use of the word spores, in which we use spores for bacteria and we use spores for fungal organisms, and they're really different. One is part of a reproductive cycle for fungal spores, and one is part of a special survival structure, and that's a specialized bacterial cell, the only specialized bacterial cell, that is the bacterial endospore. So we use that same spore twice, so the term's classified. Likewise, budding is used as a mechanism of release of a virus that's an enveloped virus from the host cell, budding. But we also use that same term budding when we talk about the mechanism of, again, fungal organisms, but fungal organisms in the yeast stage, which are single cells. And when they produce the next generation, which is sort of, it looks like a Mickey Mouse with one ear, that little blood on the outside of that. So they're not the same size, so it's not binary, they produce a true thing of a bacterial form. The fungal organism produces a little budding structure. Now we'll talk more about fungal later, but I want you to remember that when we use that term twice, it means different things. So budding can be part of the replication of a yeast form of a fungal organism, and budding is the mechanism of release for an enveloped virus. And when it buds through the host cell membrane, it takes with it the membrane, the lipid bilayer of the host cell. Now, budding can be very fast, and lots of viruses are bud from the surface of the host cell, animal cell. And in the process, the animal cell actually shrinks in size as it moves into more and more of the membrane, and eventually that will kill the cell in a matter of hours. But some budding is extremely slow. In fact, there's a homeostasis in the sense that the budding release is not any faster than the process of making more membrane. And so that budding release can last for decades. So we have different kinds of rates of budding release, stealing membrane all the time, and resulting in an envelope of virus. And we see some viral organisms that are RNA genomes, single or double stranded, enveloped and non-enveloped. Cellular requirements. We can have a host cell, it's a bacterial cell, and that particular virus is called a bacteriophage. We also can have an animal cell host, and therefore that one is called an animal virus. So the sort of animal virus in context makes some sense, but in one sense, animal virus is almost an oxymoron. What is it? Animal virus. Clearly, it's a variety of viral life form. And there are also viruses of invasive insects and other life forms. Here we see the replication cycle of a bacteriophage. And we see our bacteriophage over here on the far right. And you notice it's indicated a mature phage particle. Okay. Phage being bacteriophage. And it's got a rather interesting kind of almost like a lunar landing graph kind of structure. It has the head piece up here, which is like a nucleocapsid, and inside there is nucleic acid, which can be RNA or DNA or double-stranded DNA for a variety of bacterial viruses. This particular one is double-stranded DNA. Then we have some other pieces. You see, we have a collar piece, and we have tail fibers. And at the very end here, we have tail pins. So we have a collar. We have a tail fiber, and the tail pins. And during the process of replication, these bits and pieces will be all gathered around inside a cell, and they have to be then assembled. Once assembled, bacterial viruses will be released by a bursting process. Bacteriophage, we do not see them with the lipid line structure. They are all sort of naked nucleocapsids, but they're rather involved in structure. The attachment to the surface of the host cell is done by the tips of the tail fibers, so these little legs, like spider legs coming out there. And so the six of them, I guess, call it the insect and spider them. Anyway, so we have the little spider-like legs. And those are the part where it binds to the surface of the cell. If the host cell, a bacterial cell, was a gram-positive organism, quite likely the targets would be varieties of lipotechoic acids. So that binding that wound its way through the urine layer and sort of a patchy layer on the surface, on edge, it in fact is where we often have receptor sites for the virus to attach. Once that attaches, these will actually flex. You can see where they've sort of got knees on them and they can bend. And as it flexes, it brings this tail pin close to the surface. An enzymatic reaction then will occur and it will basically put a hole in that cell wall. Then the collar contracts and injects under about 70 atmospheres pressure, a lot of pressure, injects nucleic acid into the cell. Once we have that occurring, so this structure was on the outside of the cell, we now have the infectious process beginning. Okay, so all of what we described, this one we described, what the critter looked like, this is the bacteriophage, and it lands on the surface of a bacterial cell, and once it enters its genetic information, you then will have the production of a various sundry of pieces of messenger RNA, which will then code for the various kinds of proteins. In sequence, you see there's an early and a middle and a late. One of the early proteins, one of the early messengers produces an early protein. These often are DNA polymerases, that is, when you're making the genomic material. So the genomic material is sort of sitting around, and then we're going to make the various parts, and then we have to assemble it. Once it's assembled, we then have the release of the virus by a bursting or a mini event. We can see this all occurs in about 25 minutes. This particular bacteriophage is known as a T-even. And there are subcategories of that. They're all like T2 and T4 and so on. T-even numbers. And they have this particular interesting kind of structure. Now, part of what I mentioned there is a universal concept with respect to all viruses interacting with their host cells, and that is receptor site matching. We said that tail fibers met with the lipotechoic acids, and that resulted in receptor site matching. So receptor site matching is a dual system. We have a structure on the target cell, produced by the target cell, interacting with the structure on the surface of the virus, produced by the virus. It's sort of a lock and key, kind of, you know, not specifically like that, but there's a uniqueness to it. Now, this unique interaction results in host specificity. That is, does the virus invade human cells, or plant cells, or animal cells, or whatever, dogs and cats, and so on. Host. And tissue specificity within that host. That is, does it involve combining brain tissue, or does it involve the GI tract, or the lungs, or the respiratory tract? Where? Where does it bind? It will bind anywhere its receptor-site matching allows it to bind, but again, that's something produced by the host and something produced by the virus interacting. So the receptor-site matching accounts for both host specificity and tissue specificity. All of that sounds like, yeah, okay, that sort of makes some sense kind of thing. But let's put it into a little more of a clinical moment. Someplace in the last 100 years or so, we don't know exactly when. We don't know exactly where, but we think it was probably in Africa. A virus that caused a problem in monkeys, known as simian immunodeficiency virus, seemed to have crossed over species and invaded humans. It did so because it is a single-stranded RNA virus, and as we've indicated in the past, a single-stranded RNA virus mutates a lot. Remember, double-stranded RNA and double-stranded DNA have a complementary base pairing, so therefore they're more stable. They don't change as much. Single-stranded DNA and single-stranded RNA don't have that double-stranded complementary nature, and therefore a change is a change. And we mentioned that inside of a patient with HIV that they have thousands of changes during the course, probably millions of changes during the course of infection. So we have simian immunodeficiency virus, a single-stranded RNA virus, mutates, so now it has the ability to invade human cells. And we have the native population, the natural population, humans in this area, and they are using monkey as a source of meat, and they are butchering the animals in the jungle, in the forest, and so on. So it's easy to imagine someone butchering an animal, getting the blood on their hands, getting a small nick in their hands, and getting the virus in them. Okay. When I tell the freshmen, they say, aha, they're having sex with monkeys or something like that. No, they're not having sex with monkeys. Okay. But anyway, so we have the humans getting it properly through cuts on their hands and getting the blood into an animal, nothing unusual there. And the disease was recognized going back to probably the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, but not well diagnosed. In the 1960s, it was called Slim's disease because the people got skinny. It was not understood where this disease came from, and again, it was an African population that didn't have much gravitas in terms of economic concerns of the first world countries, so they just let it happen. It wasn't their problem. And then eventually it spreads into the rest of the world, and then it was supposed to be human immunodeficiency virus. Now, we have a virus now that has the ability to bind to receptor sites that are identified by the use of antibody, a special kind of antibody, very specific antibody, known as a monoclonal antibody, or MAB. And the monoclonal antibody is used to describe structures on the surface of cells of your body. And we identify these by so-called CD markers, cluster of differentiation, which means it's identified by a monoclonal antibody. And so every cell of your body has a variety of CD markers, and we'll talk more about that when we get into the immune system and such like that. So we have a marker known as CD4. These markers are usually receptor sites for proteins, sort of like ears of the cell, where they pick up a protein and bring that, transduce that information, something bound to that structure, into the cell, and the cell activates or something. Moving up, use of these markers has many reasons, but there's surface structures, and if something binds to some of them, that's bound signal transduces through the cell membrane and activates a piece of messenger, and that cell produces a product. That's one thing. Others are adhesion molecules where something comes along and attaches, and again, that attachment, sort of like feeling the outside world, the cell is blind, how would it feel about things? Well, it feels this attachment, the adhesion kind of thing. And that also gets transduced to the process, through the membrane, and activates the cell movement. So it's basically a bunch of sensory organs in the surface of the cell. So CD4 is one of the many that you have. But CD4 is found on subpopulation of T cells, known as helper T cells, and also on macrophage population, like city cells. The virus has a structure on its surface, like for protein 120/160, and it's got different weights there. But it's a glycoprotein 120/160, depending on how you actually purify it, and that interacts with CD4. So we have a structure on the surface of the virus that interacts with the surface of one of our cells, interacts as a receptor site matching, allows the virus then to get into those cells and replicate, and the rest is a big problem we'll talk about later. But obviously we're destroying those cells, and those cells are essential for you to have an immune response. So therefore, your immune system collapses and you die of a wide variety of other infections. Now, that surface CD4 marker is not available to just casual contact. Someone could sneeze and they're not going to spread AIDS. Shaking hands with somebody generally is not going to spread AIDS. Because the marker itself is buried. It's inside the body. Now we also have other viruses whose receptor sites are a little more exposed. Maybe H1N1. Okay. H1N1 may infect tens or 100 million people in this current worldwide pandemic. A pandemic doesn't say anything about the severity of illness, it simply means the number of people that get infected. So it doesn't mean it's going to kill people in the millions and millions and millions. But it can infect people in the millions and the millions. And the receptor sites for that are the respiratory tract. So when you do sneeze, you do spread the virus and it goes to someone else's receptor site and they get infected. Or if you get it on your hands and rub it in your eye, then you do get infected and so on. So we have two viruses, one that can kill you but can easily be spread on a relative basis, and the other one can easily be spread but is not going to kill most people that are infected. Probably 95% or 98% of the people infected are going to survive, whereas in the case of HIV, the survival rate is extremely minimal. Okay. Unless you get hit by a bus, you figure you're going to die of AIDS at some point in time. Complications associated with AIDS. So its survival rate is approaching zero. What happens if a patient is infected with AIDS and comes down with the flu? What happens when those two viruses are together in the body at the same time? What happens then? Is it possible that HIV could somehow pick up the ability, if not from that virus, another virus, to invade other parts of the body and be more easily spread? And the answer is yes. So HIV could mutate or pick up, theoretically, different abilities to bind to different cells, retaining the ability to wipe out your immune system, but at the same time now being able to spread because of someone sneezing. Now we have simply changed the receptor site matching. We just added another little nuance, not creating a whole new thing. I mean, viruses have these receptor sites, it's nothing new. So now we have gone from a virus that is difficult to spread but highly fatal to one that is extremely easy to spread and highly fatal. Now we can wipe out millions and possibly billions of people. That could be out in the future. That's a bad scenario, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility. It's a possibility. And all the difference, all we change is the receptor site matching. On the other hand, we have a single-stranded RNA virus that mutates and it loses the ability to bind to CD4, doesn't pick up anything extra, and it disappears. Completely gone. A footnote in history. In the late 1900s, in the early 2000s and 2001s, that's the year 2100, right, there was this anomaly that we talk about in the year 2500. This had happened 300, 400 years ago, and it was wiping out people with a sexually transmitted disease that everybody knew about. Now we don't have that anymore. So in one situation, we wipe out the world population, and the evidence of footnote and some test and some exam 200 years ago. The only difference is receptor site matching. Now, one of the good things about receptor site matching is that in most cases, it is what your body is actually going to respond to. Remember, we talked about the bacteria relationship with virions and immune response. And so, if we have a virus that wants to bind to ourselves, if we use that surface structure of the virus as an antigenic target, we develop an immune response to that, an antibody, that will block the ability of the virus to bind to ourselves. That could be a good way of developing an immunizing agent. And that does work for many viruses. You all have been immunized with hepatitis B surface antigen. You're not going to immunize with the actual virus. There are technical problems. We can't grow the virus very well. So we've taken the genetic information of the virus to produce the surface antigen, that is, the receptor site. And we put that genetic information for the viral receptor site for hepatitis B, and we put it into a yeast organism, recombinant DNA technology. Now the particular strain of yeast organism is going to mass-produce surface antigen, and that's what we were immunized with, a yeast product, not the virus at all, but a yeast product that we deliberately and intentionally put into the genome of the yeast, so it now produces this receptor site. And that's what you're injected with. So now you have a new response to the receptor site. And that works many times. Unfortunately, glycoprotein 140-160, that surface receptor 120-160, 120-140, there's several clusters. Those viruses, those glycoprotein receptor sites in the surface of HIV, do stimulate antibodies, but those antibodies are not protected. So at this point in time, we have not found what we refer to as the correlates of immunity, that is, those factors that result in protection, those factors that are found in the convalescent or recovering body, sera and their lymphocytes and so on. So we can't find anybody whose immune system has fully rejected the virus and they're fine and healthy and dandy. We have some long-term survivors for HIV. We don't have anybody that actually is cured in the same sense that we see other viruses. So therefore, we don't have a natural immune response that we can mimic through the development of a vaccine. And our attempts to develop vaccines so far have failed. We produce the antibodies, but the antibodies are not protected. So all of this is receptor site matching. So the difference between one disease and another, how does the virus code and cause this problem and that problem and so on and such, what is our immune response directed against? All of that is receptor site matching. Extremely important. Without it, we have no infection. If we can block it, we can prevent infection. If it changes, the host specificity changes from simian immunodeficiency virus to human immunodeficiency virus. And if HIV picked up a variety of tissue specificities, it can invade not only the immune system cells, but CD4-positive helper T cells as well as macrophages, there may be a epithelial tissue and be spread by genes in it. Mechanism of entry. This is a broad stroke kind of thing, how things get into cell. It depends on the host. If the host has a cell wall, then the virus enters by infection. If the host has a membrane structure, it's going to end in fibrotoxis. Now, injection is sort of described already. It attaches to the receptor site. In bacteriophage, you can see that injecting into the host cell. Fibrotoxis occurs when we have a lipid C, a little lipid structure, and an iceberg sits on there, a protein of some sort, and it's the receptor site. And so when the virus binds to that receptor site, that bobbing up and down structure, it then sinks through the membrane and then is released on the inside. That process is known as viropraxis. So binding to a surface protein or glycoprotein, and then sinking through the membrane and being freed on the inside of the cytoplasm. That's viropraxis, not an injection. And generally speaking, injection occurs with bacterial viruses invading bacterial cells, and viropraxis occurs with animal cell viruses invading animal cells. So because of the nature. Now, there is sort of a little bit of a question, well, what happens with mycoplasma? Mycoplasma, of course, is a bacterial organism, but it has a membrane. We think it probably enters in by a viropraxis-like structure as well. Although there's some debate. So bacteriophage generally enter in by injection. And animal cells enter in by viropraxis. How do they get out? Bursting or budding. Bursting is when they're all released at one time. Bacteriophage always release by a bursting phenomenon. They've got the cell wall that has been blown apart. Animal cell viruses can release by either bursting or budding. So they have a choice in a sense. So therefore we can have animal viruses that are naked nucleocapsids that are released by bursting, or we can have animal cell viruses that are enveloviruses released by budding. So as soon as we see that structure, we know how it was released. We see the budding process. We see the making of the nucleocapsid, the RNA, or this has to be a single-stranded RNA virus. And we make the RNA, and then it's surrounded with the nucleocapsid. The nucleocapsid pushes its way through, and then we have a budding release. Notice that the point where we're budding through the membrane has these little structures on it, and then they're on the outside of it. These are virally directed structures. So they're viral proteins and glycoproteins floating on the host cell membrane. And when the budding occurs, it then looks, as you see here, where we have the nucleocapsid with nucleic acid inside it. We have a membrane that is still from the host cell. And then we have viral-derived glycoproteins on the surface, which are receptor sites. So we put those receptor sites out there. T-cell lymphocytes. And the T-cell lymphocytes will result in an attack on the virally infected cell. And the virally infected cell then will be destroyed even before the morning. Being the target of T cell lymphocytes that will then recognize a virally infected cell and destroy it before we have the release of virus. So there's a two-pronged attack by the replication of the virus vis-a-vis your immune system. An antibody that binds to the receptor sites on the free virus that prevents it from invading cells, such as hepatitis B surface antigen preventing it from invading your liver, and it's part of your T cell recognition of a virally infected cell. So the T cell will then destroy the manufacturing center for this virus before it produces another round of virus. Receptor site matching. Targets of both antibody and T cell attack. So your immune system then can distinguish between virally infected liver cell and non-virally infected liver cell by those receptor sites. Now, interestingly enough, there are other biological settings in which these structures like this appear. Certain types of cancers are known to be associated with viruses. Others are not particularly associated with viruses. But there are some similarities between a virally infected cell and a cancer cell. And one of those similarities is there are structures that appear on the surface of the tumor cell, of the cancer cell, that are tumor-specific, so they're associated only with the tumor. And the only time we see them in the body is when that tumor is present in the cell. Or they are tumor-associated. Tumor-associated structures found on the surface of cells are those structures which are out of time. They're not at the right time. For example, liver cells, when infected with cancer cells, or when liver cells are, transformed into tumor cells, when a liver cell is in that setting, it can produce something called alpha-fetal protein. Alpha-fetal protein, as the name suggests, it's something that is produced during fetal life. And alpha-fetal protein sort of rise and fall during gestation, normally. And alpha-fetal protein sort of rise in the first trimester, and then they sort of reach a peak in the second trimester, and then they fall off and disappearing by the time the third trimester. And we use that alpha fetal protein as a marker of liver cancer. Now, what alpha fetal protein is found on the surface of cancers that are liver origin. So here we have a normal protein only found during gestation, now being expressed by a tumor cell. So it's a tumor-associated antigen. It's not unique to the tumor. It's something that's in your genome to do, but now is not the time to do it typically. Yet that's what's happening. And it's marking the cells, and that's part of your immune response. Now these can be shed. They can be locked off. And they can be found in the bloodstream. And they can be used as markers of infection to some degree, or in this case, markers of cancer, but they're usually used in terms of prognosis rather than diagnosis. We find that a lot of people have other kinds of liver problems and they have these antigens floating around in their bloodstream. It's not normal, but they may not have liver cancer. Maybe they have cirrhosis or other things going on. If we recall, the liver can regenerate itself, and it's probably part of that process. But if you have had liver cancer and we cut it out, they put you on chemotherapy, you can have a loss in the amount of alpha-fetal protein, the surface receptor site chemicals, in the bloodstream. And then we can monitor your blood over the next 6 months, a year, and 6 months from now, and 6 years from now, and every 12 months after that. We can monitor it over a period of time, and if the alpha-fetal protein levels, which are being shed by the cancer cell, are out there, then we know that they're rising, we know that you have a return of that cancer. So they're used for prognosis, predicting the future. And that's only one example. There's a carcinoma, prion antigen, CEA, GI tract cancers, and so on. So what we have is some similarities here. That is, you have a virus that triggers the production of viral antigen from the surface of an infected cell. And these can be shed on occasion. And now we have tumor cells having the same sort of things. And if these are part of what your body would recognize as being foreign, being unusual, being the target of an attack for protection purposes. Let's go back to that. This is where we were. We were talking about the integration. Found on the surface of the host cell targets for T cell response, whereas the ones out here are targets for antibody response. We classify viruses using the various kinds of information that we gather about them, and then there's the International Committee on Viral Nomenclature, ICVN, and for nomenclature. When we first began to classify them, we classified viruses on the kind of disease that it made. That is, there were viruses that caused encephalitis, and there were viruses that caused respiratory tract infections, and there were viruses that caused GI tract infections, for example. Then we began to look at them more carefully and see that there were viruses that were DNA viruses, there were RNA viruses, and so on. But we couldn't get a single system that would be able to be good enough to give us enough detail that we can actually find uniqueness so that we knew that in blah, 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 in Russia versus Vienna, Austria, or San Diego, California, that we're actually studying the same virus. How would we know we're studying the same virus? It's causing the same disease, but it may not be the same virus. It's a DNA or DNA or RNA, super double standard, but there's a lot of those. How do we know we're studying the exact same virus? Of course, we need that to develop the virus and develop the vaccine and study it more completely. So we developed a cryptogram, a little series of statements. So if we complete that information, we've got to the level of information that we got uniqueness. And the first statement is the genomic nucleic acid. Is it RNA or DNA? Is it single or double stranded? So each of these four statements will have two parts. This happens to be DNA and RNA and single and double stranded. So you might have D1 or D2, R1 or R2 as our first statement. And then we put a colon and then we have a second statement. This is molecular weight, two parts. And these two parts are sort of like a fraction, so we have above below the line. And we have a colon, so we have DNA/D/2, colon. R/1, colon, single or double stranded RNA DNA. Then after the colon, we refine our second statement, which is the genomic nucleic acid. What is its weight, the non-insignificant figures, we just want one number, and that number is always times 10 to the 6th. So the genomic nucleic acid times 10 to the 6th. It could be 0.5 times 10 to the 6th, or it could be 5 times 10 to the 6th. Or it could be 50 times 10 to the 6. Not insignificant figures, but whatever that number is, it's times 10 to the 6. We don't put 10 to the 6 in there, we just put a number. Then the B part below the slash is the nucleic acid as a percent of the total weight of the virus. So does the nucleic acid represent 10% of the total weight of the virus, or 1% of the total weight of the virus, or what? 15%? So whatever that percentage is, that's the number. Okay. So So it could be, the second statement could be 50/1, meaning that the nucleic acid is 50 times 10 to the 6th total weight of the nucleic acid, and the virus total weight compared to the nucleic acid. Nucleic acid was a 1% of the total molecular weight of the virus. 50/1. After the colon, we have the shape. The shape of the virus, as we look at it on the microscope, electron microscope, and the shape that is the nuclear capsule. Now, if it's a naked nuclear capsule, they're going to be the same. If it's an envelope nuclear capsule, they could be different. They are. So if it's a naked nuclear capsule, it could be a complex box with 22 sides. And that would be the shape of the virus and the shape of the nucleic acid if it was a naked nucleic acid. On the other hand, if that same naked nucleic acid structure was now covered with a membrane, it could be spherical shape of the virus with a 22-side box for nucleic acid, the box being inside the lipid. Again, that gives us information about the structure, but also gives us information about the mechanism of release of vitamin E. And again, this will be the naked nucleic capsid. There's an envelope virus, and you can see we have this circular structure here, spherical, with a box-like structure on the inside of the envelope virus. Notice that these structures have, on the surface of the envelope virus, we're talking about the receptor sites already. You see the receptor sites. What about the naked nucleic capsid? Well, they have substructures in the sides of this nucleic capsid. And those substructures are called capsomeres. And the variety of capsomeres on a given side have different functions, and yet that same capsomere crystallized structure is repeated again and again and again and again. So let's say the middle one here is the receptor site for the epithelial tissue. Likewise, the middle one here is that receptor site, the middle one there, and there, and there, and there. So these are repeating structures, but that facet, like the diamond ring facet, that surface, is composed of a variety of capsomeres, each having a specific function. The receptor site matching can be one of those functions. Again, it's what's happening on the inside. So both of them have receptor sites, both of them have nucleic acids, both of them have a nucleic capsid. One has only a nucleic capsid, and the other one has an envelope. The last has to do with the host and a vector. What is the host of the cell, the virus? Is it an animal cell host? Is it a human cell host? And is there a vector? So, for example, we're talking about the yellow fever virus or the West Nile virus. We're talking about viruses like that. And the virus has a vector that is a mosquito. Where we're talking about influenza virus, or human immunodeficiency virus, there's no vector. A vector is an intermediate host, in a sense, that's involved with the spread of the virus to humans. So we have host cells and vectors. And there are many of the virus cells that don't have vectors, but if it does, that's something we're going to put in that classification system. So there are four statements. The first statement was the genomic nucleic acid. The second statement was the molecular weight statement. The third statement was shape. And the fourth statement has to do with host and vector cells. So once we have identified that, we know now that in San Diego, in Boston, in Vienna, and so on, we're all working with the same virus. The next thing we want to do is start finding differences between a virally infected cell and a normal cell. And we've already mentioned some of those. There's receptor sites on the surface. That would be an important difference. And that is the difference that our immune system recognizes. And that's how, in part, we can destroy a virally infected cell or a tumor cell and so on because of those unusual structures on the surface. But there are other differences, internal differences. And these differences have to do with how the nucleic acid is replicated and how it's copied. So we call that the expression of the animal virus genome. Again, we have RNA and DNA viruses. And they can be single or double-stranded. We also have some viruses that are be not only RNA, but can be converted into a DNA form during the replication, back and forth. It's like DNA viruses that insert themselves into a genome. Other viruses that can do that would be herpes virus group and so on. And we also have viruses that are RNA viruses that insert themselves as a DNA equivalent into our DNA genome. And that would be the retroviruses, which are RNA tumor viruses, and included there is of course, HIV. So HIV is a retrovirus. It gets its name because the transcriptase is going from a direction opposite. Talk about that, retro factor. So to take a look at these transcriptases that are involved in replication, now this is occurring inside the cytoplasm of your cells, your infected, the host cell. And these transcriptases, these enzymes, some of them are your enzymes. So either the virus brings its own enzyme, which is just like your enzyme, possible, but not likely. More likely is the virus uses your enzyme to do that. Okay. So whenever possible, the virus will not bring in something that you have. It only brings in that which is unique to it. So for example, if a Toyota virus was going to take over a Ford plant, they would keep the worker enzyme putting on hubcaps and wheels and so on. It would all be there the same. Okay. It wouldn't change. Yes. I think it just died just about 30 seconds ago. And no, there may be. So, yes. So we have the Toyota virus invading the host cell. And when it does that, it doesn't need to bring in from Japan worker enzymes that can replace wheels on vehicles and so on. But rather it will bring only in those technicians required to make the label Toyota. Okay? And bring in some blueprints to develop a new kind of vehicle. So we have a blueprint that comes in. And of course, it's the virus, it's the genomic information. And some things, but not everything. So it doesn't need to bring in a whole bunch of workers. It just brings in a handful. And now the enzyme workers for the Ford plant are now making Toyotas. Okay. It's that kind of thing. So the virus does not bring in a whole bunch of new enzymes, but it doesn't have to. So again, if these transcriptases are duplicates, then it's probably going to be something that the host cell will provide in the virus form. And therefore, that particular transcriptase would not be a good target of opportunity for a drug because then you destroy normal cells. What you want to destroy are virally infected cells. So we have to pick and choose among these transcriptases to find those which are unique to viruses. So let's take a look at this. This first one here. Here we have the genomic information. This plus minus means double-stranded. So we have double-stranded DNA. We have a plus strand and a minus strand. The minus strand is designated as the template for complementary base pairing to make plus-stranded messenger. So our Rosetta Stone, our code-breaker idea, is that messenger RNA is always plus-stranded. And the piece of DNA that's required to make that, the piece of nucleic acid required to make that, must be minus stranded. So the messenger RNA determines the minus strand of this strand, and then the complementary base paired to that minus strand is going to be plus stranded. So we have plus minus, which means not uncertain, but rather double-stranded DNA. And we have a transcriptase that will do that. Now we name the transcriptase in two manners. Again, complicated kind of naming system, but the purpose of that is to identify potential targets for viral drug. So this is a transcriptase that's making RNA. So it's an RNA transcriptase. So transcriptase Roman numeral 1. These were developed by Baltimore and Wang and husband and wife team 25 years ago that identified these transcriptases and named them. And transcriptase 1 is a RNA transcriptase. But the other part of its name is that it's genomic information that encodes for that particular transcriptase is a piece of DNA. So this transcriptase, Roman number 1, is made under the direction of DNA. So this is a DNA-dependent RNA transcriptase. DNA-dependent RNA transcriptase. All of your transcriptases, by definition, then, will be DNA-dependent. All DNA virus genetic information, all DNA viruses produce DNA-dependent transcriptases. RNA viruses, on the other hand, will produce RNA-dependent transcriptases. One of our points of difference. So we have, this is a normal kind of thing, you're making messenger RNA in your cell, double-stranded DNA viruses do the same thing, use the same enzyme, probably your enzyme. So this would not be a good target for an antiviral drug. Now here we have a single strand genomic information. This is not normal for us. It might be part of a repair enzyme process, however. So here we have a transcriptase. It's a DNA transcriptase because it's making DNA. And it's a DNA-dependent DNA transcriptase. So it might be part of a repair enzyme process, where if we lose one strand, we're going to make the other, and we make double stranded. But this is also an essential part of what a virus that was a single-stranded DNA virus would have to have. A DNA-dependent DNA transcriptase. Then, if we want to go then from the double-stranded DNA to messenger RNA, we have to add transcriptase number 1 over the dotted lines to complete the process. Transcriptase number 3 is a RNA-dependent RNA transcriptase. Clearly something that we don't have. Clearly a good target for opportunity for an antiviral drug. We have a double-stranded RNA genome. The transcriptase 3 is going to take the minus strand of this and convert it into messenger RNA. Notice all of our targets is the messenger RNA. Once we get the messenger RNA, then it's all the same. Messenger RNA, whether it's an RNA virus or a DNA virus, single or double-stranded, or your own normal messenger, is going to sit on your ribosome using your transcriptase to make the protein. So it's talking about a viral messenger, the viral messenger RNA, in this case, this piece right here, is going to sit on your ribosome, and your enzymes and your transfer RNA will be used to make the protein. There's no difference there. Okay. So and that's not a good place then to interfere with the process. We have to do it upstream in the process. This is a good target. So transcriptase number 3 is an RNA-dependent RNA transcriptase. Transcriptase number 4, another RNA-dependent RNA transcriptase. And notice that we've got plus-stranded, single-stranded RNA genome. We're going to make a minus strand because why? We have to make a minus strand. Make you Charles. This is from Charles. So we have this making of an intermediate. We have to make a minus strand in order to make a plus strand. Okay. And we have to make a plus strand because messenger RNA is plus stranded. Now this particular virus is its own messenger. So this viral information, the single-stranded RNA virus, could be its own messenger RNA. It might come into the cell and produce protein. Okay, but still, even if it did that, make more of itself. So in this case, we're looking at two ways. We're looking at using the genomic information to make a minus strand so it can make messenger RNA. We can do that. It can come in as its own messenger RNA and sit on a ribosome and direct protein, but in the process of replication, it would have to copy its own genome. So what's listed here as messenger could be its own genome as well. So it's a double deal there. You could have a minus strand genome coming in, and we have transcriptase number 5, or 105, which converts it directly to plus strand and messenger. Transcriptase number 6 is the reverse transcriptase. This takes, it's an RNA-dependent DNA transcriptase. This is the one that's associated uniquely with RNA tumor viruses, with retroviruses, in this category, and of course HIV methods. And it is the target of antiviral drugs, our early HIV drugs that are approaching. So we have RNA, genomic information, coding for DNA. That's going in the opposite direction. It was first identified by a fellow by the name of Temin, University of Minnesota. It was thought to be wrong, because everybody thought that genetic information flows from DNA to RNA, from RNA to protein. That was the central dogma for molecular biology. And when Temin put out the idea that these things existed, ultimately supported by Baltimore, the same fellow that the initial reaction from the scientific community was, this can't be the case. Watson and Crick studied it for about a week and a half and came back with, nope, this looks good to me. And suddenly everybody said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. There it goes on that. So we have a reverse transcriptase and an RNA-dependent DNA transcriptase. And of course, we're going to need another transcriptase to take this strand into double-strandedness. There it sits inside the host cell, waiting to be activated. Once the virus, as its DNA equivalent, is activated, it will be activated through its messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA then will sit on the host cell right away, using host cell transfer RNA, making viral protein. So RNA tumor viruses that have this must go into the genome for at least one round of replication, one copy of the genome. In the case of retroviruses, sometimes it stays inside the cell for decades before this virus gets made. One of the approaches in research then is to find out what triggers this dotted line. What triggers that to be activated? If you're infected with a retrovirus and it's hidden away inside your cells and it's in a turned-off mode, it's not being transcribed, it's doing no harm, although the potential is great. Is there some way we can seal that sucker in so it can't be copied? And the answer is yes, and there are techniques being used to do that. Here you see, am I using the microphone? It sounded like this guy. It is perfect. It runs through batteries in 4 minutes and 8 seconds. Maybe something else. One of the turn-offs. So we have the example here of a single-stranded RNA virus that makes a DNA equivalent, and the DNA equivalent is inserted into the host cell genome. There it stays. One of the techniques being used is to take a virus that invades the location where the first virus has inserted itself. And so we take another virus and deliberately infect the person. So we immunize the person by infecting them. And that new virus enters into someplace along the line here, in several locations, and maybe at the beginning, and maybe in the middle, and it will disrupt then the ultimate activation. Basically, we've separated the virus from itself. We cut it in half. And we've inserted another virus. It's a dummy virus. It's a design of gene kind of virus. And we insert that in there. So we have viruses that want to use that. We've done this with some brain tumors. Yeah, we've actually infected the brain tumor with a virus, and the virus then prevents the brain tumor from becoming activated, and therefore from replicating, and therefore the tumor doesn't get any bigger, etc., etc. So there is a molecular biology approach that they ultimately use to sort of seal in these RNA tumor viruses, including HIV. So an approach would be to live with the virus, but having had this insertion in there that disables the virus. Now, of course, it has to be 100%. And we have to get them all. If we only get 20% or 50%, it's not sufficient to stop the replication. Slow it down, live a little longer, we reduce the number of viral copies, but it's still not effective. We want something closer to 100%. It's an approach. So if we look at these, again, looking at this process, we have the target here, making messenger RNA, so-called sense, plus stranded. And you can see the various viruses, how we can get from where we're going. Here we have T4, we mentioned that with the bacteriophage. And we also have vaccinovirus, which are double-stranded DNA viruses. And just so that you know, it's by convention here, they're double-stranded, plus minus. And it shows how we would go from that. You use the minus strand to make a messenger. Okay. We could have a single-stranded RNA virus in which we have to make a minus strand, a plus strand. We have a double-stranded intermediate, and then go from that, taking the minus strand of the double-stranded intermediate to making messengers. So there's several different ways in which we can go about it. So we have retroviruses such as HIV. We use reverse transcriptase to make a DNA equivalent. And then from that, we can then take the minus strand of this and produce plus stranded messengers. The rabies virus is a minus strand, so we basically can use that as a single stranded RNA virus. We use the minus strand as a template, and we basically make messengers. Polio is itself plus stranded single stranded RNA. Poliovirus, the genome, is messenger. Can be used directly. We said that was a possibility. And so here we have an example of a virus whose own genome is messenger RNA is going to be polio. Now the process of replication involves several different steps. And again, the steps could be places where we might use an antiviral drug, so we need to understand this life cycle. Stole this from an online source, and I don't know why, but we e-dropped that. Viral cycle. So here we have the attachment. That's the first stage. Receptor site matching. Then we have enterin by viral taxis. So penetration is by viral taxis. And remember that involved a matching of host cell receptor sites and virus. The virus did not invade unless the host cell had that structure. We don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but obviously they both need to be there for the virus to invade. In a sense, the host cell cooperates. Now, it may be that the virus mutated to a point where it masked the receptor site. But nonetheless, we have cooperation at this point. Then we have penetration. Once we get into the inside, now we're in the cytoplasm. We have uncoating. The uncoating process is, again, host cell enzymes that are being used to free up the genomic information. If the host cell does not open this Pandora's box, if it doesn't open it up, nothing bad will happen. But it can't help itself. It has enzymes in the cytoplasm, and the structure of the virus is structured so that those enzymes, when present, will actually do the job. Again, we have that same sort of the virus involved in having the right kind of proteins. You can argue that way. But nonetheless, what happens is that we now have a structure that can be digested by host cell enzymes. If that doesn't occur, we have no uncoating. Without uncoating, we have no replication. Once we have uncoating, we have freed up the genetic information. We're going to make some proteins. So first we have to make the messenger RNA, and then we're going to make the proteins that can make translation. So transcription is making the messenger RNA, and then we have translation of the protein. Some of those proteins will be seen out here as receptorcytes. Proteins are glycoproteins. Other proteins are going to be transcriptases. Any transcriptase that the host cell doesn't provide that the virus needs is going to be made at this point. And now we also then will then make many copies of the viral genetic information. There'll be an assembly process where it's all put together, and then there's a release. In this case, the release is by budding. Remember, it could have been released by a bursting process as well. Co-infection. We alluded to the possibility earlier. Now we're going to expand upon it. Co-infection means that the host cell is invaded by more than one virus at the same time. Can happen. Often does happen. Now when that happens, we can have two infections ongoing into the cell at the same time, each sort of fighting for the host cell's resources, fighting to get their transcriptase on the host cell ribosome, and fighting for the presence of transfer RNA to make that particular virus's proteins and so on. So they can be sort of coexisting at the same time, competing for resources inside the cell, and then they're released. That's one thing that can happen. Another thing that can happen is we actually have defective viruses. A virus that does not make sufficient levels of, say, transcriptases, both level and actually variety, doesn't make the necessary transcriptases, and the host cell is not providing them. It's a dead end. This cannot exist. But it does. It exists because it can invade a cell that's already invaded with another virus. So we have a defective virus invading a cell that already has been invaded by a fully competent virus. So the first virus is in there doing its thing. It's going to make itself. It's fully capable of taking over and making more viruses. The second guy comes in, and he doesn't have all the equipment. I have a neighbor that has no tools. I don't think he has a screwdriver. So every time that something goes wrong, he calls me over, and do you have this, and do you have that, and so on. So he's sort of a defective virus. He's trying to fix things that he doesn't have a screwdriver. He doesn't have a screwdriver. He doesn't have a hammer. Anyway, so his wife's got a toolkit, and she's got a hammer. She doesn't know where she keeps it. She's totally not into the tools. He's into Shakespeare and things like that. We all have our expertise. So basically, so he's sort of the defective virus in that sense, right? As long as I'm around, he's got tools. It's the same thing. The defective virus invades the cell. It cannot make all the things that it needs. And by itself, it would invade the cell. It gets inside. It gets uncoated. And then it dies. But if it invades the cell that has the right other virus in there, the defective virus gets made. It doesn't get repaired. It's still a defective virus. But now when the host cell releases the viruses, they part their ways. The fully competent virus is off invading cells again. And the defective virus is out there trying to find another cell that's already invaded by a cell, by a virus. An example of that would be hepatitis D, as in Delta. Hepatitis D. It's a defective virus. It can only invade cells that are infected with hepatitis B. So, having been immunized against hepatitis B, you should not get hepatitis B infection, and you're also protected against hepatitis D. It's a twofer. Who knew? So these defective viruses can cause problems. They can certainly make the infection worse in the patient, more complicated outcomes because we have two different viruses.
but it never really becomes a fully competent article. Then we have a possibility of two defective viruses invading a cell at the same time. Each one is incompetent and cannot reproduce itself, but if they have different defects and together they can provide what totally is needed, then they can replicate. So two defective viruses can come in. One can do transcriptase 1, and another one can do transcriptase 4 or whatever, and they are able to collectively reproduce one another. Again, they are not repaired. They are released as two defective viruses. So those are all possibilities. We're concerned about these defective viruses. We mentioned hepatitis. There are some viruses that may be associated with tumor formation that require other viruses to invade the cell, and then once in there, it triggers the tumor production. So by preventing the first fully complete virus, we prevent tumors. There's research on that area. There's another area that's of interest, even as we speak, and that is some viruses have segmented genetic information. We don't call them different genes, we just say that their genomic information is segmented. For example, influenza virus has a segmented several different pieces of RNA. And this segmented virus, you can imagine now, if we have two varieties of the same virus, or two different viruses, so two varieties of the same virus, but with slightly different genetic subunits invading one cell. Or if we have a cell with two different viruses, complete viruses, not defective in any way, but they get in there and they all have these segmented kinds of things. Well, the offspring can have some assortment. So you've got seven different segments and you've got five which you used to have, but you picked up two new ones. And the two new ones may give you receptor sites that now gives you, you know, a different variety of host cells that you can invade. This is exactly what happens in the case of the seasonal flu. Seasonal flu epidemic. You know, we get our flu shots every year, totally aside from H1N1. And we have this flu season every year. So this year we have to get seasonal flu immunizations, and we'll get H1N1 immunizations. How is it always changing? You don't have to get measles every year. You get measles shot when you're younger, and that's it. Why is it that some viruses you have to do this? Well, the reason for it is they've got segmented genetic information, and they're invading different things and reassorting the cards. So we have, on an annual basis, we have bird migration from the Arctic area down through the eastern coast of China, along the shore there, along the eastern coast of China, all the way down through the peninsula, Indonesia, all the way into Australia, sometimes even into New Zealand and so on. Okay. It's maybe a 4,000-mile migration of birds. And the birds are flying along and they have to land every once in a while. So they land in a pond outside of Shanghai, let's say. And in that pond is another duck. We have the migrating bird and the duck. And the duck sneezes and so on, and back and forth they go, and they slurp around each other. And now we have the virus going from one respiratory tract to another. And now we have viruses that are invading the same cells, and they're reassorting their genetic information. That particular animal could be a bird where this reassortment occurs. It could be the human source. If you're in Asia, you'll find, although, interestingly enough, they are starting to get the disease of supermarkets. So they're actually starting to have supermarkets in Asia, in different countries, China and so on. But typically, classically, birds are sold live. And they've all ducks and all kinds of birds. Pheasants, chickens, ducks. So, and they're all sort of crammed into one cage in one area. They're all coughing and sneezing at each other. They're alive. And then you buy this alive chicken. That's how fresh it is. It's still alive. no frozen chickens there. And so basically what happens then is that they are in stress area, the birds are stressed, they're all spreading one another, and the person selling them is going to get infected with this newly recombined virus, or they will be the ones infected with both viruses. So the recombining, the reassortment, as we say it, can occur in animals such as birds, or in humans, or in pigs. So that's why we have avian influenza, bird flu. That's why we have swine flu. Those are the locations where those reassortments occur. And if reassortments occur because we have co-infection, we have a virus that has a segmented nucleic acid, and they share segments. And as a result of that, we have new strains of the virus that come about on a seasonal basis. So co-infection has lots of different clinical implications. What happens when a virus and a host cell come together? Well, we can kill the cell. That's cytosolic. Sometimes it can kill the cell in a matter of a half an hour. And sometimes it can kill the cell in weeks, or months, or years. You can also have a persistent infection. This does not kill the cell. It sort of leaks out a little bit of virus for a long period of time. Persistent infections can last for decades, slowly producing virus all the time, never quite killing the cell. A latent infection is when the virus enters into the genome and is quiet. Latency is a quiet period. And while it's in that hidden state, that quiet state, it's not producing any virus, usually not producing any viral protein, so there's often no marker. Well, sometimes there is a marker, but oftentimes there isn't. But there's certainly no virus. By a marker, I mean maybe a small amount of the viral protein is produced, and that viral protein then is maybe found on the surface of the cell or secreted from the cell or somehow found associated with the cell. But typically, the virus itself is not. It's hidden. And then we have transformation. In transformation, that latency, that integration into the host cell genome, results in the transforming of that cell become a tumor cell. So for transformation to occur, we have to have latency. But not all latency results in transformation. So in order to get it turned into a tumor cell, we have to have it inserted into the genome. And just because it goes into the genome doesn't mean that it's in fact going to result in the production of the cancer cell. Now here we see some examples again. Pictures of what we just saw. We have a lytic infection, resulting in the death of the cell. We have a persistent, which is slow release without death. We have a latent situation where the virus is present, but it's not really producing anything. At some later point in time, it can become lytic. Okay, it can release the virus. For a long period of time, it can be lytic. And then we have the production of the tumor cell. Now, what path does the virus take? It depends on the host cell, the tissue itself, not the host person, but the tissue that it finds itself in. Now, every cell of your body has, except for sperm and egg, the exact same genetic information. But just different bits of that information is being turned on and activated, making messenger, making protein. So the proteins inside the liver cell are different than the proteins inside of an epithelial cell and so on. And obviously they function differently, but the genetic information is all the same. So when a virus invades a particular cell, what is turned on, what is available to it, will depend upon what type of host cell it enters into. And that's part of the environment then that will help predict which route will take. There may be also individual host genetic factors which can be involved in this as well. So, for example, we can have measles virus invade through the respiratory tract causing a leading infection in the respiratory tract, which results in a viremia, the virus coming throughout the bloodstream, which in turn results in immune reactions which give us our rash, so like allergic reaction. Give the rash of measles. Then you'll get an immune response. That'll be T cells to virally infected cells and antibodies to the free virus, and you'll recover. And that's what usually happens to most people. Some people, during the viremia stage, will develop a pneumonia and encephalitis and die during this acute illness. Usually they have an immune deficiency, but not always. It could be malnutrition states and so on. There could be other host factors which predispose them to coming this other route. Some people, when it's in this viremia stage, it will enter into the brain as a persistent infection. And they'll have a slow amount of virus produced for the next 10 years or more. Now, this is a slow production of virus that then invades other brain tissue, and slowly over the next 10 years or so, we will see more and more damage done to the brain. But it's very, very slow. We have something called SSPE. SSPE. Subacute. Means it's a quiet kind of problem. Didn't know you had it. Subacute sclerosing. Means scar formation. Subacute sclerosing. PAN means throughout encephalitis. SSPE. Subacute sclerosing, PAN encephalitis. And so we have this process of the virus integrating into the cell and never leaving. And you got the measles when you were 5, and now that you're 13 or 14 or 15 or something like that, you're diagnosed with SSPE. And we looked at your body, and you have high levels of antibody to measles. You have high levels of antibody not because you were infected at age 4. Those antibodies should have gone by now. But you have high levels of antibody now because of this persistent infection. Some people will be invaded with hepatitis B. And when invaded with hepatitis B, it's usually about a 6-month kind of acute illness phase. Okay, so it's a significant kind of illness, if not the common cold. So we have this 6-month illness, and then most people will recover, but not all. About 10 to 15% will develop a latent infection, which will turn into a cancer, or a persistent infection, which we call chronic active hepatitis, which also can lead into developing a latent infection and a cancer. So we have a chronic active state that you never ever get better. It doesn't get better after 6 months. You have it for maybe 10 or 12 years, and then usually die of liver failure or liver cancer. Now remember that the liver regenerates, so you have this tug back and forth between the persistent infection resulting in destruction of liver cells and liver cells dividing and reproducing themselves and regenerating. But that process tips in favor of the virus in favor of the patient after about 10 to 12 years. And that's another good outcome. So when you had that hepatitis B immunization, you protected against hepatitis B acute illness, which would maybe last 6 months. You protected against chronic infections, protected against persistent infections, protected against liver cancer. So you've been immunized against the cancer. And you've also been immunized against hepatitis B. All of that because you've had hepatitis B surface antigen. Okay. So that sounds like good news. Now there's only one little caveat which we'll talk about. We made this hepatitis B vaccine very, very specific. And there's something about our immune system that it doesn't like to respond to us. So to avoid developing an immune response to us, we all have little blind spots. Something that overlaps with us, we don't respond to. Usually the antigen is very big, and the spark, the part that we don't respond to, is just sort of a small thing, and we respond to the rest of the antigen. So most vaccines, there's something in there for everybody. But hepatitis B surface antigen, really small. It's a recombinant DNA product, very small. Most people will respond to that, but about 15% of people don't see it. In our clinical trials initially, you may recall a series of 3 immunizations you had. We went as far as 6 and 7 immunizations. For those people that did respond, the 3, they didn't respond to 6 and 7 either. It's probably an overlapping itself, so we need to maybe modify that vaccine to give it something a little bit bigger so that we can get everybody to respond. So although everybody's been immunized, not everybody is protected as much as we've talked about. Not everybody is protected against getting hepatitis B, hepatitis B, persistent infections, liver cancer, hepatitis C. There's about 15% that aren't. So in any given pharmacy class, there's a few people. And the only way we know whether it worked for you is if, in fact, we actually do the serological testings and see if that we're producing the right kind of immune responses. So again, many outcomes possible between the virus and the host cell, not always predictable. Leading infection is certainly possible in most cases, but persistent, latent, and transformation are also possibilities. So what causes a certain kind of problem with one age or one person can cause other problems in other people. Childhood illnesses, which may be no big deal for most people, can lead to more serious problems in other people. So it's preventing problems of people who might be getting problems in their teens, or their 20s, or their 40s, or their 60s, or their 80s, by immunizing children and preventing the initial childhood problem, we can then prevent a lot of long-term problems as well. Now we had a growth cycle, not of an individual bacterial cell, but of a colony of cells. We looked at lag, log, stationary, and death, and we saw what was going on at different times in that process. Likewise, we can look at the viral replication cycle. And that can have, that can occur in various parts. Initially, what we did is we looked at the number of viral particles, that's there in red, the viral particles per host cell. And we would put maybe the number of viral particles per host cell over here. And they would then disappear inside the cell culture. And the process of disappearing is called the eclipse period. And it would go along for quite a while, and all of a sudden there'd be new viruses made, and it was called the rise period. So when our marker was actual virus, that's the virion. We saw the numbers disappear, be gone, and be reappearing. And they're reappearing with the next generation of virus. So this is in a cell culture. The viruses are disappearing because they're attaching, entering by viral plexus, replicating, and only when they come back outside and the cell is being lysed and so on and being released do we see a rise. That gave us some indication of what was going on, but not enough. We needed another marker, another way of observing what was going on, a little more detail. So we began to look at progeny nucleic acid. Should have been a yellow marker. Progeny nucleic acid. And we saw that the progeny nucleic acid began to appear at a certain point. And by definition, as soon as that appeared, we said it was a late phase. And before that, it was the early phase. So as soon as this line begins to rise, it's a late phase, not just at the point. As soon as we have the progeny nucleic acid, the next generation DNA being made, the next generation RNA being made, we have the late period, by definition. So obviously the late period occurs before the rise, that is, you're making progeny nucleic acid before you assemble the molecules. assemble the virus, and then it's released. So we have two different marking systems describing the same series of events. Eclipse rise, we're looking at the presence of virus in the cell culture outside the cell. And if we're looking at the production of nucleic acid early and late, and the progeny of nucleic acid, the next generation. If we look at any period of time, we might have more than one definition, we'll have two at least, markers. So, for example, if this is the point right at the beginning where we have receptor site matching, receptor site matching is going to occur in the eclipse period and in the early period. And if we talk about the release process, the budding or bursting process, that's going to occur in the rise and in the late period. If we talk about the point in time in which we have progeny nucleic acid made, that's the definition of the late period. And we talk about the very first piece of progeny nucleic acid, the beginning of the late period, that's going to be late and eclipse. If we talk about the period of time, not the point in time, not a specific point in time, but a period of time, a period of time in which the late period is existing, that is the period of time when we have progeny nucleic acid being made, that's going to be by definition the late period. But it's also going to be part of the eclipse and the rise period. Okay, see how this chart can be interpreted? This is often seen on examinations, so you can be clear how this works. So if you do have, at any point in time, you will have two terms. A period of time, a range in time, you could have two, or you could have three, or you could have four. In this period of time, there, in the early period, there are this early messenger RNA that's made that makes early proteins. In the late period, there's late messenger RNA that makes late proteins. So if I ask, at what point in time do we make the early messenger? You would say, what period of time? Well, what period of time early? That would be early and eclipse. And what period of time do we make the late messenger? That would be late, eclipse, and rise. And if I said, at what point in time do we make messenger RNA? That would be early, late, eclipse, and rise. It's a little confounding, but it's no different than what you might find on a package insert, where they put a lot of different information on one graph. It's the same thing. Key in understanding this is, what is the marker? What are we looking for? In the case of the eclipse and rise, we're looking at the presence of virus. Presence of virus particles in a cell culture. We put them in, they disappear, and new viruses are released. Eclipse and rise. And early and late, our marker is the production of the next generation nucleic acid. As soon as we make the progeny, that's the next generation, progeny nucleic acid, we are now in late period. Another way of thinking about this, it would be, you have nosy neighbors. You have nosy neighbors. The nosy neighbor is old spinster lady named Sally, and her brother, who lives with her, he's a creepy guy named Al. Okay? And every time you come into the house, Sally, you see the curtains. She's checking out. She saw you go in. See the curtains. Look at that. That's Sally. As it turns out, you rent from Al. And before you moved in, Al put all these sensing devices. So once you're in the house, he can record it. That little map of the place. Now you just went from the living room into the bathroom, and now you're back out. And you can see me follow. Little infrared sensing devices. And he can follow you inside the house. That's what we got. We got Sally looking at eclipse and rise, and Al looking at early and late. Early and late's occurring inside the cell. Okay. So we're looking at these markers inside the cell. They're both describing the same process. Eclipse and arise from the Enlightenment. Take a look at the early period. It begins with absorption. Absorption. And here we have the binding of the receptors of the virus and the binding of the receptors of the cell. We talked about receptor site matching before. A really important step. As it turns out, in a laboratory setting, in the lab, doing this in cell culture, we find that this reaction of absorption, this receptor site interaction, is dependent upon temperature and the presence of diol and cations. Now, these are observations in the lab. They're not going to be problems in the clinical setting. And all that's telling us is the temperature dependency, the temperature of the membrane influences its fluidity. At room temperature, 25 degrees centigrade, the fluidity is not very great. So you bind on the outside of something, it's never seep in. The viscosity of the membrane is greater, and the movement within the membrane is greatly reduced. Hence the temperature dependency of the reaction. In the case of divalent cations, they're positively charged. Living entities, such as cells and viruses, and we call viruses a lot, are typically negatively charged. Bringing together two negatively charged particles, particularly one being a large cell and the other being a small virus, would be very difficult to do. The charges would be repelled, and you couldn't get the virus close. By adding divalent cations to our cell culture media, we reduce that difference. We neutralize the charge. And now we can bring the parts together. So something that's highly negative is going to repel cells. So something like saran wrap and so on, roll out. Saran wrap is sterile. Because living things can't stick to it because it's negatively charged and they're negatively charged. Now they may be hovering just microns above it, but they're not on. Spirochexis, this is the entry process now. Entry of our effects. Then we have the viral encoding. So just as in the case of receptor site matching, the host cell has to cooperate by producing the right receptor site. Likewise, in viral encoding, the virus has to produce those enzymes to encode the virus. Now, when we break up this nucleocapsid, I said some of the nucleocapsids, I pointed to the five and I pointed to one in the middle and said, well, arbitrarily we're going to say this one's involved in the surface site matching. But what do the other guys do? Well, they can have biological activities once they're broken up. So we're not only freeing up the nucleic acid, but we're breaking apart these little pieces, these nucleocapsids, which then have specific biological activity. So for example, if this was an RNA virus, it's going to specifically inhibit DNA synthesis inside that cell. It doesn't need the waste nucleotides making DNA. It's an RNA virus. It wants you to make virus. It's not interested in the cell continuing on. And so there are specific inhibitors or specific processes that the host cell would normally be doing, so it would be counterproductive to what the goal of the virus invasion is going to be. Now, can you think of any particular advantage to someone doing research on a nucleocapsid that inhibited DNA synthesis? Of what value would it be to construct a virus that would invade a cell and once invaded would release these particles that would shut down DNA synthesis? You have a virally infected cell. Okay, so you use it as an antiviral treatment. Is there another kind of problem we want to use? Exactly, tumors. So in response to tumors, so there's research being done where we have these dummy viruses that recognize receptor sites of the tumor, and when they get inside, there's nothing serious in terms of infection there, but when it's released, the tumor cell breaks it apart, and all these nucleocapsids shut down the DNA synthesis and kill the virus. Remember, we always have to have that selective toxicity, that specificity. We don't want to kill all the cells. We just want to kill the cells that are tumor viruses, not when we identify them. Remember those receptors I talked about earlier? There's markers on the surface of tumor cells that distinguish them from non-tumor cells, normal cells. We can use those as markers for the virus to enter in and release these compounds, which are toxic. And they're only toxic once they're broken apart. And they're only broken apart when they're inside the cell. Notice there's a theme here. We're talking about selective toxicity every time we turn around. Because that's the essence of developing treatments against diseases or cancers or whatever. And whenever possible, we try to use the natural phenomenon. Antibiotics produce normally, right? One mold produces a compound. Here we're talking about a virus used to treat a tumor. Also in this period, the early period, we have the synthesis of early messenger RNA. Early messenger RNA basically will produce transcriptases. Any of the transcriptases that the host cell is not providing, the virus must make. And it makes it as a product of early messenger. Structural protein, these are generally in late messenger. But enzymes necessary for replication, so we're making transcriptases as part of early messenger. Late period we will discuss next time.